Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. This week on Through the Smoke, Chief Dave Paulison, new FEMA director, and we'll also be catching up with report from Engine Company 82's Dennis Smith. You know, starting as a firefighter in Dade County, Florida, Chief Dave Paulison has been involved and affected by as many emergencies as any of us, and he's never forgotten where he came from. Hopefully, that's the wisdom behind the most recent decision by President Bush to appoint Dave as the man in charge, Undersecretary of FEMA, the FEMA chief in the Department of Homeland Security. Dave has stated that he's going to work with FEMA to make America proud of that agency, and in itself, that will be a challenge. Listen in as Dave talks with us about some of his ideas and plans, as well as his message for what he has for his brothers and sisters in the American Fire Service. And this week, we're also going to be catching up with Firehouse founder Dennis Smith. Starting as a firefighter in the South Bronx, Dennis decided one day to write a book, and the rest is history. While Report from Engine Company 82 started it, Firehouse Magazine continued it, and numerous other best-selling books and accomplishments sustained Dennis's motivation. Join us as Dennis shares his history and his perspective on today's fire service, his involvement with the September 11th Families Association, the National Firefighter Near-Miss Reporting System, and what Dennis's most recent ventures are. But first, we've got a couple of newsworthy items. Most critically, it is with deep regret that we advise you of the line-of-duty death of DeKalb County, Georgia firefighter Bill Craddock. Bill suffered a massive heart attack while operating at a house fire in May, and he's been hospitalized since then. Many of us knew Bill, and certainly many of you did, as one of the finest instructors, for example, at FDIC, a very, very active instructor for years at FDIC, as well as many other venues, probably one of the most dedicated and finest fire instructors you've ever met. Bill's dedication and enthusiasm for the job was second to none. So tragically, he leaves behind his wife, Shantae, and their four-year-old son, Colby. We'll provide additional details regarding services and memorial activities as soon as they become available on firehouse.com. We do know that originally we said that the memorial service and funeral was going to be on Sunday, but it's not. It's going to be on Saturday at 2 p.m. in the North Metro Atlanta area. Again, check the website. We'll have the information on there for you. Also, check with www.foolsinternational.com for details as well. Again, we're sad to announce the tragic line-of-duty death of DeKalb County, Georgia firefighter Bill Craddock. Rest in peace, Brother Bill. It is also with deep regret that we advise you that Deputy Assistant Chief Michael J. Day, age 49, of the Providence, Rhode Island Fire Department, died on June 13th at 21:30 hours. Chief Day was on duty at the time. He had responded to a working fire earlier that evening. He was found in his office unconscious and CPR was administered. Chief Day was in his final year of EFO at the National Fire Academy. We will post additional as it becomes available. And, of course, our sympathies go out to the family of Chief Day, as well as the officers and members of the Providence Fire Department IFF Local 799. And also, yesterday, one firefighter was killed in the line of duty and four others were injured when their apparatus struck a tree in Sydney, Australia. While we don't always cover international news, it's important that this be brought out because what affects us affects them and vice versa. The pumper was responding to an automatic fire alarm that turned out to be false when it clipped a semi-tractor trailer and then plowed into a tree. It took almost 2 hours to extricate the last of the four firefighters from the wreckage. The apparatus driver was flown out in critical condition with multiple fractures to his legs and pelvis as well as significant abdominal injuries. Another firefighter was also critically injured, with the other surviving firefighters having minor injuries and shock. The civilian truck driver was not harmed. There are no other details we have right now, but of course our sympathies go out to the members of the New South Wales Fire Service and the related family members. Another accident involving apparatus. And, you know, last week we talked about firefighter Brian Hutton, who was killed. And there's a lawsuit going on involving his family and the fire department and the makers of the apparatus because the door opened up when he fell out. And, of course, we also stated that he was not wearing a seatbelt. Many of you know Dr. Bert Clark from the National Fire Academy, who's also a Firehouse.com contributor and has a show as well. And he did an article called Leadership, We Killed Firefighter Brian Hunton Last Year. And we have a link to that right here on the website. If you scroll right down where you click to hear the show, there's a link to that. And Bert wrote me, and we chatted for a bit, the fact that he received an email that made the loss and responsibility that Bert felt even deeper. Jim Juneau contacted Bert. Jim serves on an NFPA apparatus tech committee, and he met with Brian's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Hunt, to talk about their son's death. And Jim gave Brian's mom and dad a copy of Bert's article to read. The article, as I said, called We Killed Firefighter Brian Hunton. And Brian's dad read it, and he said, how many more firefighters have to die before we all start having to wear seatbelts? And at the time, Mr. Hunton was wearing a National Fire Academy ball cap, which only made it more important for Bert to focus on this issue. Bert started telling Brian's story, and he asked his NFA students to make a pledge to wear their seatbelt and to make sure their other brother and sister firefighters were wearing seatbelts as well. Well, now I'm asking you on behalf of Bert, the Hunton family, and everybody else who gives a damn out there, if you will take the National Fire Service pledge, the National Fire Service seatbelt pledge. Basically, you need to promise you're going to wear your damn seatbelt. And also, as an officer or a senior firefighter, have the courage or the guts to make others wear their seatbelts. It's a big deal. We keep seeing firefighters getting ejected, critically injured, and killed, and it doesn't have to happen. So take a look down below, click the pledge, fill it out, pass it around your fire department. It really might make a difference. The National Fire Service seatbelt pledge is to remember firefighter Brian Hunton, and it's a promise we can live with. It's not that big a deal. Just put your seatbelt on, shut up, and sit down. From now on, no firefighter should have to die because they weren't wearing their seatbelt. You owe it to each other, you owe it to your families, and really anybody who cares about you wants you to wear your seatbelt. So please, give it some thought, put the damn seatbelt on, and quit whining. We're also following a story regarding the Memphis Fire Department Hell Night. Memphis, if you remember, we talked about this last year and it was posted. Memphis attorneys and the family of a firefighter injured during Hell Night are talking about a possible legal settlement. The former recruit spent nearly 2 months in a coma, and now the family wants the city to pay up. It was all about alleged hazing at the Memphis Fire Department during a training event commonly called Hell Night. But while the city is anxious to wrap it up, the firefighter's family and the lawyer is saying not so fast. Memphis city leaders promised their firefighter training has changed since some controversial 2004 video was recorded of the event. On the video, you can see supervisors yelling at recruits and saying, you swing that axe like a little girl, I don't think you're going to make it, you better hurry up. And I don't know that that's so tough. I mean, firefighting is tough business, but absolutely there is a line. Firefighters call it Hell Night, and it was the same event that firefighter James Coleman suffered a heat stroke, and his attorney explained slipped into a two-month coma. When you have a supervisor, this is the attorney I'm quoting, when you have a supervisor challenging your manhood, telling you that they'd have to carry you off in a body bag before you quit, and things like that, it sends a message that these guys just can't quit. And I guess that's what they're pushing as the issue, that they didn't give the firefighter a choice. Even their bodies are telling you to quit, but you don't pay attention to your body. So it's a bad situation. It looks like they're working on a settlement. And, you know, what's to learn from here is that we got to treat firefighters with respect, although they still must understand how tough the job is. But it also doesn't mean we demean them or put them in situations where they may slip into a coma or even lose their lives. Well, we'll be back in just a couple of seconds talking with Dave Paulison, the new director of FEMA.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Well, we're back on Through the Smoke with Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder, your host. We've got David Paulson, the newly appointed director of FEMA, one of our own, starting as a firefighter in Dade County, Florida. Dave's been involved and affected by many, many emergencies. And he's got over 30 years on the job, and I still consider, and I think any of us who've been firefighters know you're always a firefighter, whether or not you're still going to fires or not. Dave was chief of the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Department in that position. He had 1,900 personnel and a $200 million operating budget, and he also oversaw the Dade County Emergency Management Office. Dave began his career as a rescue firefighter and rose through the ranks of rescue lieutenant commander, district chief of operations, division chief, assistant chief, and then deputy director for administration before becoming the Miami-Dade fire chief. Dave is a certified paramedic and firefighter, and as fire chief oversaw the Miami-Dade Urban Search and Rescue Task Force, and in his vast amount of experience, he also includes being the incident commander of the Hurricane Andrew situation and the crash of Value Jet Flight 592, and of course, Dave is a past president of the International Association of Fire Chiefs. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Billy.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I know how busy you are, and the fact that you've taken time to talk to the brother and sister firefighters is a big deal. Before we go forward, I want to comment, and this is personal from me to you. I couldn't have been more proud when you controlled the interview with Matt Lauer on the Today Show last week instead of allowing him to control you. It was great, and his comment about you living where you do and being able to afford things to prepare your home in the event of a hurricane, I think your answer was right back, and your response was, and you can verify this, was that you don't have to have a whole lot of income to have a flashlight, to be prepared to have a first aid kit and things like that. So I just thought that was a great comment, and I was real proud of that.
Thanks, Billy. One of the incidents, a really important issue for me is personal preparedness. There are people who simply cannot take care of themselves, but those who can need to do so, because it really distracts from our first responders out there when they have to rescue people or go take care of people who simply should have been able to take care of themselves to begin with. Lessons that I learned coming up, with dealing with disasters and hurricanes and everything else. And so I'm trying to instill that here as I'm in charge of FEMA to get that message out to the American public. American public simply has to take a better charge of their lives and take responsibility for taking care of themselves and their family.
We really saw that with Katrina, and obviously, people could spend all day identifying all the problems that came out through that. And you've been now, you woke up one day and found yourself in charge of all this, and with a lot of us hoping and praying that we'd be better prepared for response. But it really does come down to not only the public being prepared, but the local fire department being prepared, and we're going to chat about that in a few minutes. Let me ask you a couple questions. First, you went from United States Fire Administrator, which I described the fire administration as being a cubicle down the hallway at FEMA.
Billy, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We got a problem. Our fire alarm has gone off in our building.
Oh shit!
And I'm going to have to evacuate.
All right.
can we pick this up again later?
Well, we're back with Chief David Paulison. The fire alarm went off at FEMA, so setting the right example as a longtime firefighter, he evacuated the building. We're going to have to do a full investigation to see if that wasn't a way just to get you out of this interview. Dave, I was saying that at one point my opinion was that, and obviously no reflection on you or any of the folks that work at the United States Fire Administration, but in FEMA's view, the United States Fire Administration was a cubicle down the hallway in the basement of FEMA. What about the USFA now, and now that you've gone from the United States Fire Administrator, literally a small organization within the FEMA scope, how has that changed your view, scope, and perspective as far as the United States Fire Administration within FEMA?
Well, the Fire Administration is not in FEMA anymore. It's over in the Preparedness Division. But it hasn't changed my view at all of what the Fire Administration should be doing. And that is, it needs to be responsive to the fire service out there, making sure that we're teaching the right things, making sure we're doing the right fire prevention activities, making sure we're simply giving our firefighters out there the tools they need to do their job. So my view, regardless of where I sit in the which seat I sit in, my view has not changed at all.
So FEMA still falls under DHS, but not under the FEMA section. Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct. The Fire Administration is still inside of Homeland Security, but it falls under the Preparedness Directorate, which is George Forsman.
Okay. Now, should there be or is there a link between USFA and FEMA based upon the fact that both fall into, the fire service? We're sort of the common link between the two. And I know at one point we were concerned, so we pushed to try and move it But what's your thoughts on that? Is it right where it needs to be? And do we have good lines of communication through your office to the fire administration?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Charlie Dickinson, who was my deputy as a fire administrator, is now the acting director of the acting U.S. fire administrator, and just doing an outstanding job. So that link is always going to be there. We're very close to probably naming a new fire administrator. George Forsman and I have been working together, along with Charlie Dickinson, on selecting that person for the job. So there is a link there. There has to be a link. It's always been there, and it always will be there, regardless of where it actually sits in the organization.
Mr. Forsman, very well, but I know you and Charlie, and I know if the two of you are involved, then we're going to get the right person in there. Dave, let me ask you a question as far as the fire services role. Just some general thoughts as far as our relationship with FEMA, and you know, what's your thoughts to the fire service? You got to have some feelings as far as not only what happened during Katrina, but generally.
Well, I think that what I see the fire service, I think where it needs to go, particularly in the emergency management / preparedness piece of it, is the fire service is probably one of the most respected agencies in any community. And if any group is going to be believed and accept the direction on where they need to go, I think it's got to come from the fire service. So what I would like to see is the fire service get more involved in the personal preparedness issue, the critical infrastructure protection issue, those types of things where we need a credible spokesperson. And there is no more credible spokesperson in a community than whoever's representing the fire service.
Let's carry that up one more level. We locally clearly play a very important role. I mean, there's no doubt we're the first responders, but then after that, what? And my question here is, do we think we're a lot more important than we are as far as the FEMA and the federal government role?
Oh, I don't think so. And I think the fire service is much more than first responders. We do that, and we do it better than anybody else. But at the same time, we are the force up front that's getting our community ready to respond. Who else is out there talking about prevention? Who else is out there talking about fire safety? Who else is out there talking about safety around the house? It's the fire service. And so I think that we are much more than first responders and need to step up and take that role and take it to the next level.
How do we, but back at the federal level, how do we enhance our image? I mean, unfortunately, and this is a fact, we've known this, we come across in so many different voices to those in Washington. What would your advice, I mean, you know, getting us all to sing off the same sheet of music is important, because as we've heard members of Congress and Senate, and even the president, whether the current president or past sitting presidents, you know, which fire service am I talking about? Is there any voice or any advice you can give us, or if you could click your heels and make a wish? Isn't there a better way we could be coming across as one voice of the quote-unquote fire service?
I know there is. You know, we talked about this the last time I was on the show, and I hear it from congressional members all the time also. You know, who am I listening to? Is it the volunteer side of it? Is it the union side of it? Is it the fire chiefs? Is it the Hispanic? Is it the black? Is it women firefighters? You know,
right.
I need to, you know, they say, I need to know who speaks for the fire service. We just had a meeting recently when we were talking about the U.S. Fire Administration and where it was going to go and about the funding for it and the fire grants and all that. And probably for the first time in a long time, we brought all of the fire service groups together and got them on one page behind a common goal, which was beefing up the U.S. Fire Administration. And that sent a message. And I think those are the types of things. There's always going to be differences. I mean, the IFF is going to have a different agenda than the National Volunteer Fire Council, and maybe have a different agenda than the International Association of Fire Chiefs. So, but there are a lot of common things that we can work on together. You know, firefighter safety, better turnout gear, better self-contained breathing apparatus, better radio systems, how we're going to communicate. Those are the types of things that we can come together on, and we can take as a single voice to Congress and say, you know, this is important to us, and these are the things that we want Congress to help us with to get funding for.
And we really did see that, not only with the USFA issue, but when you were the fire administrator and then under the direction and leadership as well of Ron Sarnicky and Gary Breeze, basically the three of you brought us together under the Fallen Firefighters Foundation down to Tampa for the summit. and we absolutely are seeing significant trends and changes and cultural changes in firefighter safety. So that certainly is a good example that you mentioned, that there are ways we can succeed and still maintain the diversity that we all fall into. Dave, let me ask you a question. Sadly, we kept hearing every newscaster, every reporter failed in FEMA. You couldn't hear the word FEMA without the word failed. And I know that, I can tell you, when I got hired as a fire chief years and years ago, our old friend Warren Isman said to me, find a place that's not doing so good and go there. You can improve. And those weren't his exact words, but you get the message. You were thrust into the leadership of FEMA during a storm, literally in a political storm, and now you're in charge. You've been confirmed, and we're so thankful for that. Are you able to bring on some assistant coaches to help you fix some of the failed issues? So that's sort of an outside question. The inside question is, what are you doing to boost the morale and the spirit of the folks at FEMA, of which there are many, many good folks?
That's a good point, Billy. There are tremendous people inside this organization that have literally been working 7 days a week for the last 2 years, a year and a half. I keep hearing FEMA failed. What people have to recognize is Katrina was the overwhelming event that FEMA simply was not designed to handle. We normally house 2, 3, maybe at the maximum, I think in 2004 in Florida, when we had 4 hurricanes, right. I think we housed like 5,000 people. Or 5,000 families. In Katrina, we have either provided direct housing or housing assistance to over 900,000 people. We also have put 115,000 families in travel trailers and mobile homes, and that's just in a few short months. So we did a lot of good things. Now, having said that, there were some things that didn't go well, and I can quickly point some of those out that we're working on. One was logistics. Logistics is having the right things at the right place at the right time. We simply did not do a good job of that. Didn't have enough supplies, didn't have the right method of distribution. The whole system was not what it needed to be. What I've done is I've gone back and looked at what do we have? And I'll give you an example. We had before Katrina, we had 160 tractor-trailer loads of MREs in stock and no backup. So what we've done this year is I have 770 truckloads in our warehouses right now, and I've also done an MOU with the Defense Logistics Agency, which is the logistics arm of the U.S. Army, for backup. So they will be filling our warehouses behind that.
Sort of like mutual aid almost. That's pretty cool.
Sort of like mutual aid, except we got to pay for it. The other thing is FEMA did not have a system to track any of the tractor trailers. Once they left our warehouses, we didn't have a clue where they were. Sometimes the drivers got where they're going, sometimes they didn't, sometimes they got lost, sometimes they just went home and spent the weekend home with their kids. So major problem. We have purchased and implemented a very sophisticated GPS tracking system, something that should have been in place a long time ago. So we can track real time every one of our tractor trailers. I can pull up on a huge computer screen here in FEMA and says, just tell me, okay, where are all my water trucks, where is all my food trucks, where are all my blue tarps, and it'll immediately show me exactly where they are, down to the street corner they're sitting on. That's a tremendous business tool for us.
That's outstanding. It's almost like an accountability system. It's basically not a whole lot different than when you were in Dade County trying to track your companies and determine the nearest ones, what resources you need, and additional. I mean, obviously it's a much larger challenge because there's so many other segments and tentacles to this whole thing. But really, by using ICS and the way we run fire departments on a day-to-day basis, that kind of stuff can fit right into what you're doing.
Oh, exactly. And one of the other big issues was communications. Major breakdown in communication between the local and the state and the federal government, and in fact, inside the federal government itself, quite frankly. We did not have a unified command system set up. We were not sharing information. And simply that one of the reasons you saw a lot of the confusion. So we've made very clear that we are going to follow the National Response Plan. The Joint Field Office is going to be the hub, and that is where we're going to work out of our incident command system and use a unified command. We've done tabletop exercises at the assistant secretary level, at the deputy secretary level, and even the secretary's level inside the White House. So everybody understands now that what the National Response Plan is, how it's going to operate, and we are going to have a unified command system, and we are going to work together on our 12-hour blocks of our planning and how we're going to do our operations for those next periods. So these next times are going to be much more coordinated and much better communications in place.
That's a heck of a statement. I have no doubt that you've done that and are going to do it, because I know you. We just hope that we don't have to get tested, because we saw all the devastation, all we went through with Katrina, and all the long-term battle and pain that not only the people down there suffered, but it was a black mark on a lot of emergency service agencies all the way up to FEMA.
Katrina was a wake-up call, quite frankly, for all.
Yep.
For I think every fire department, every emergency management office, every state office, and the federal government itself, that this country was not ready for the big one. We were not ready to have to disperse 2 million people. We were not ready to house that many people. We ended up with people in every state in this country, and we've never had to do that before. So now we know that we were not ready, and shame on us if we don't get ready.
Dave, again, firefighters get it, but there's a lot of people within FEMA who don't get it. Do you think they get it now? Have you put training programs in place so they understand what emergency response is, so they understand how they have to communicate, how they have to be able to move a lot quicker than they did? I mean, did you develop some way to help them get it?
I think the answer was not so much the FEMA rank and file employees didn't get it. We had a lot of people at the management level of FEMA who did not have the background they should have had, and I've changed that. Those people are gone. There's new people coming on board, and I'm not bringing anybody in the management of this organization that doesn't have the credentials and the experience behind it to make sure that those decisions are made early on, and we run down this road like we're supposed to.
That sounds great. Have you been able to recruit, I don't know what you can share with us or not, but any fire service people to help you along with that mission?
Yeah, I'm using a combination of fire service and emergency management people, and sometimes former military people to bring in. Bill Peterson, chief of Plano, Texas, I made the Region 6 director. He's already doing an outstanding job.
A real good man.
Art Cleaves was the state emergency manager for Maine. I just made him the Region 1 director. The Region 2 director out of New York is a guy that has a former fire service background and emergency manager background.
Basically, you're bringing on a couple people who, and I love the term, who've crawled down hallways. They understand.
Yeah. My response director is the emergency manager out of Pittsburgh. Worked with Charlie Dickinson for quite a few years. Highly recommended. He's a new response director. My deputy director here is 35-year employee out of the Coast Guard. He was the vice admiral out of the Coast Guard, and his last stint was running the Pacific Fleet. A lot of operational experience. So those are the type of people I'm putting around me.
Sounds like a good team. I know that time is short for you. I've just got a few more questions, then we'll let you go. Dave, how are you personally handling the rigors of this job, the 16, 18-hour days? The fact that you can't even email me as much as you used to. I'm very lonely.
Billy, I'm getting 300 emails a day. It's a stressful job, there's no question about it, and it's quite frankly, for the most part, a thankless job at times. But it's the right thing to do. There's good people in FEMA. The mission is very similar to what the fire service is all about. It's about helping people. It fits right into my my personality and how I operate. So that helps with the stress a lot. I got to thank my family. They've been behind me 100%. If it wasn't for them, backing me up, and particularly my wife Kathy, very well, she's a trooper. She endures a lot for me, and if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be able to do it. But with that kind of help and the help from the fire service that I get and the tremendous amount of support out of the fire service is just humbling. That's why I'm able to do this job.
I know your family and Kathy and them are all very proud of you, and we are too, pretty excited about you getting the job. Quick question as we start to wrap it up. The USAR team, in my opinion, the USAR teams have always been, from a firefighter standpoint, from my standpoint, the crown jewel of FEMA. It seems to work. They seem to work. My local team out here in Ohio, Ohio Task Force 1, I know a bunch of the guys in the New York Task Force 1 in Pennsylvania and some others. These are good folks, incredibly trained. I mean, they truly are the rescue squad's rescue squad. And I've always felt that, wow, that worked. It worked well. What are your plans for the USAR teams in the future, and as far as their role? I'm not a fan of any more teams, because I think if you have too many teams, then they lose their effectiveness as far as their skills. But based upon the teams you have now, what are your plans for the USAR teams?
The USAR teams, you're correctly stated, Billy, are an integral part of our response. All of them were deployed during Hurricane Katrina, and quite frankly, there are literally thousands of lives that were saved and rescued by the USAR teams. Between them and the Coast Guard, it was tens of thousands. The Coast Guard taking them off the roofs, the USAR teams, taking them out of buildings. So they are an integral part, and now that I'm in charge of FEMA, I can have a better handle on how we're going to deal with them. And quite frankly, we have to reinstitute a lot of things that fell by the wayside, particularly our advisory committees and things like that. But USAR is going to be and is a very robust piece of this organization. And quite frankly, I'm very proud of them also.
And you are going to kick back up some of the programs that had been passed on along or dropped to reinforce their role within FEMA.
Absolutely, USAR teams? They have to be. They have to be an integral part. And if they're going to be an integral part, we have to make sure we have those advisory groups together to make sure that we're doing the right things with the teams and make sure they got the right equipment and the right communications.
Right, and the necessary funding, which I know is always a big deal. Well, Dave, final thoughts from you. We just have one more minute left. Any final thoughts to the firefighters that are listening? What's your message for us?
Well, I think, first of all, I want to, I have to thank them for their support. It's just been absolutely phenomenal. And I don't think I would be here today if it was not for them. Two, I would ask them to very, very carefully look at what their role is in their community. I'd ask them to get more involved in preparedness issues, personal preparedness for the residents they protect, and also in the infrastructure piece. If they can tie in with the police and emergency management and the mayor's office to put together a task force to identify those critical infrastructures in their community, and how we're going to protect them and how we're going to respond to them. Whether it's a natural disaster, an accident, or, God forbid, a terrorist event, those critical infrastructures have to be resilient. You know, not just to be recovered from them, but also be resilient where they can survive some of these attacks. Because that's what makes a community fall apart when you lose those things.
Well, Dave, really appreciate your time today. We've been talking with Chief Dave Paulison, the Undersecretary of the Department of Homeland Security in charge of FEMA. We wish you well. We look forward to talking to you again soon, and God bless you.
Thanks, Billy, and thanks for doing a great show.
We'll be right back, as promised, with Firehouse founder Dennis Smith. Starting as a firefighter in the South Bronx, he wrote a book, and the rest is history. So hang on. We'll be right back talking with Dennis Smith, the founder of Firehouse, and so much more.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
You're back on Through the Smoke at RadioFirehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder, and our producer, as always, Eric Smith, inside the Beltway. Someday he'll be able to escape the Washington Beltway, but right now he's trapped working the controls for this show. Well, as promised, our next guest is Dennis Smith. And if you don't know who Dennis Smith is and you've never heard the name, then you just joined the fire department yesterday and we welcome you on board. Because many of us, all of us, certainly know that name. And Dennis started his career as a firefighter at FDNY in 1963. And he wrote a few books along the way, such as Engine Company 82, which was his account of life in the South Bronx firehouse that sold several million copies and was translated into 13 languages. Dennis also wrote a book that many of the younger firefighters may very well familiar with, and that's Report from Ground Zero, which also, like most of his books, was on the New York Times bestseller list. Dennis founded Firehouse Magazine in 1976, and we certainly know what the success of that is. He sold it in 91, but continues as a founding editor to that magazine that has a circulation of about 130,000 and a readership of almost a million, which is just absolutely amazing. Dennis is also involved in the New York City charitable foundations. He's a founding chairman of the New York Academy of Art. He's involved with the Kips Bay and girls clubs in the of the boys club and girls clubs in Southeast Bronx, and is also very active with the September 11th Families Association. Dennis has received numerous awards from organizations such as the IAFC for what he's done for the fire service. He serves on the board of the Congressional Fire Services Institute, and he's also a trustee of the New York Police and Fire Widows and Children's Benefit Fund. So as much as Dennis has been successful, the success comes in one end and goes out the other to benefit those he writes about, those he talks about, and those he loves about and cares about, because certainly if you've met Dennis, you know he cares about what we do as firefighters. He's another one who's never forgotten where he came from. So, Dennis, welcome to the show.
Hey, Billy, thank you so very much, and I apologize for such a long introduction. But, you know, it's what happens when you grow long in the tooth. They add more sentences to your resume, and that's about it.
Well, Dennis, how did it start? I mean, clearly, I mean, you joined the fire department because, I mean, from what I've read in several of your books, you needed a job that would provide security, and certainly you were successful as a firefighter. But what got you wanting to write Engine 82?
Well, I'll tell you, being a kid growing up in the tenements on the east side of New York. We saw as we grew up that those families where there was a cop or a firefighter who was the dad in that family, they were pretty established, and that was sort of like a good thing to be, because there were no bank presidents, you know, living on in our buildings, and we all, I think, aspired to those positions. I took the test for both. And got called for the police department investigation takes longer. It's that simple. And I got called for the fire department first, and I took it. And of course, I never looked back. And quite frankly, I didn't have any romantic attachment to firefighting at that time. I thought it was just a great job. And I have met so many young people over the course of years whose life's ambition it was to be a firefighter, and I, you know, try to help them as much as I can, put them get on the right road and give them some advice, but I never felt that, honestly, but you know, the real answer is that you don't need to feel that. It's the job that molds you, and once you get on that job and you work with the people that you work with and you recognize how, generally speaking, they are all really caring about what they do and committed and professional and hardworking and incredibly courageous without having to put it on the side of your sleeve. And I'll tell you, it's the best thing I ever did, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me was to get the job as a New York City firefighter.
Well, you said the job molds you, and it really does, and it brings out things of people that they didn't know they had in them, and it really does enhance people when you join the fire department. What was the spark that said, man, I got to write about this stuff, and when you wrote Engine 82?
Well, that just is an alignment of the stars, really. I felt that when I was a young man, I had a fairly comprehensive vocabulary, and I loved to write, and so it was a sort of an inherent gift that I had, or innate, or maybe I inherited it, who knows. It just was there, and I love to write. I'm able to put sentences together in a readable way, and it's a sort of a blessing that I can do that. And so when I was fighting fires, I started really thinking about my future. What was my future in the fire department? I wanted to be an officer. I mean, my advice to anybody in the fire department is to study, you know, is to
right. Take the test.
Take those tests and to study. And and I set my mind about doing that, but I was also in college. You know, I was also at New York University studying literature.
Okay.
And then I read a piece in the New York Times about the poet William Butler Yeats, which I disagreed with a lot. And I wrote a letter to the New York Times saying why I disagreed with this essay that was in the New York Times. And they published it.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
And under it, they said, Mr. Smith is a New York City fireman, which is how they referred to them then.
Sure.
And I got a huge amount of letters from people all over the country, care of the New York Times. And that was really interesting. And then one of those letters was from a publisher who said, you know, your letter was so adroit and to the point, I wonder if you ever thought about writing about what you do. Well, I really felt I was a writer, but I was not writing about being a firefighter. I was just too busy being a firefighter to write uh-huh. about it. I mean, I was working in the busiest firehouse in the world.
Dennis, for our younger listeners, how many runs was Engine Company 82 doing back then?
We were doing about 40 alarms every day. Now, of those, about a third were false alarms, a third were, you know, what we would call, it was before gutter medicine was
emergencies.
Gutter medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Emergencies, whether they were drug overdoses or knifings or shootings or,
right.
you know, those kinds of...
And those back then were because people pulled the box, right?
I mean, yeah, and there was a normal mayhem in the neighborhood. Those neighborhoods were pretty tough, I'll tell you. I always felt sorry when you see a young woman, you know, raising two kids on her own in that neighborhood. What she had to battle was so...
Right.
No one ever wrote those profiles and courages of you know, young women who got through
right.
those things with their kids. And some of them... You know, quite frankly, like Secretary of State Powell's family, you know, grew up in that neighborhood.
From there, yeah.
And you can see greatness in these kids. And the thing is, does the neighborhood kill them or redirect them into a life of, you know, of absolutely no merit at all? Or,
sure.
Or does the family grasp them and say, I'm going to make something out of these kids?
Right.
Which
exactly.
is certainly what happened in the Powell family.
And then a third of them were working fires.
And a third of them were working fires. Now, of all different kinds of working fires, it could be food on the stove or a mattress job, or often they were what we called all-hands fire, which is everybody in the first alarm working, or a second alarm, and, you know, occasionally the third, fourth alarm fires. But
right. So you were making all these runs, and you get this contact from this guy who says you ought to write a book. And it was no email back then.
No email.
The guy wrote you
then.
A paper letter.
That's right. It was a snail mail letter. And quite frankly, I was working on a master's degree, and I was a little uncertain whether I had time to even think about this. But I did anyway, and I wrote the book in about 6 months. You know, as you say, Billy, the rest is history. The report from Engine Company 82 is still in print. This book has been in print now since 1972.
What edition is it at this point?
Oh, my gosh. It's probably in the sixth edition, but it's probably in the 50th printing.
Printing, right.
You know, and it's been published by six different publishing companies. Warner Book now owns it. And so... I am...
started with McCall, right?
It started with McCall, and McCall, in 2 weeks after it was published, McCall became Saturday Review Press, which then became Dutton, and it's... Anyway, I published with a lot of publishing companies, but that book has truly established a standard for writing about the fire service. And what is it? It's only an autobiography, you know, it's only a memoir, an account of being a firefighter, but it, you know, it's also a story of the people I worked with. One of the reasons why I think that book was so successful is that I took, you know, I really wrote about the people, rather than writing about myself so much. I did not make myself the hero of this narrative. I wrote about the people I work with who I was enamored by and still feel you know, incredibly modest when I come before some of these guys I used to work with, and I could name them, you know.
Lieutenant Welch, Benny Carroll, Chief
exactly
Burns,
right.
I mean,
and
Mike Runyon.
All
I mean.
Of these, well, exactly right. And I see these guys still pretty often. You know, Vinnie Bolin, who I wrote about, was is now the number two guy at the IAFF.
Right, right.
And I just admire this guy so much.
What was their reaction? First of all, when they did you let them know you were writing a book, or did you write it? And, okay, what was it? Because, you know, firefighters are either, wow, that's great, or, man, we're going to target you and bust your chops, and I'm sure there was probably a good mix of that.
Yeah, well, you know, I worked in one of those really peculiar firehouses where where it was the busiest firehouse in New York, so you had all types, you know, people who wanted this kind of work.
Right.
One was a professor of sociology worked with us.
No kidding. As a firefighter.
A firefighter. It was a Marxist, this guy. And, you know, as long as you weren't out in the street with a rag in your pocket at a job, you know, you're okay. So there were others, and there was one who was an orchidologist, believe it or not, who was a real authority and was the head of the American Association of Orchidologists.
What's an orchidologist?
A person who loves orchids. You know, there are
flowers as an orchid. Oh, wow.
Orchidologist. There are 35,000 orchid species.
Yeah, I knew that.
Oh, you knew that, of course. So the point is that these men that I worked with were from all walks of life, all sorts of points of view. But what did they have in common? They loved working together. And so it was the team that I wrote about, not about Dennis Smith. I wrote about that team that made Engine Company 82 work. And I think that's what resonated among firefighters. And they learned and continue to learn something about people working together in extraordinarily stressful conditions. So Engine 82 went on to establish me as a sort of a known entity in the American Fire Service, and that gave me the ability then to start Firehouse Magazine, and then all the other books, and Firehouse Magazine gave me the ability to do what I'm doing today, which is the creation of First Responders Financial Company, which is the biggest thing I've ever done in my life, quite frankly.
And I want to talk to you about that in a few seconds. Tell us about Firehouse Magazine a little bit of the history there.
Well, Firehouse Magazine, I always felt that wonderful line, if I can paraphrase that Bobby Kennedy once uttered, which is, some people see things as they are and ask why, and other people look at things as they could be and ask why not.
Right.
Well, when I was a young firefighter and studying literature and everything else, I recognized that I loved reading about the things that I was doing. And I don't want to name the magazines, but all those competing magazines, I felt, were not serving my interests. Now, why not? Why weren't they serving my interests? Well, maybe because I wasn't bringing enough to those magazines. You know, maybe I wasn't studying for captain or battalion chief, and I didn't need to read all those articles on hydraulics. But on the other hand, maybe they weren't thinking about me, that is, the line firefighter, what we used to call the backstep firefighter.
Right.
They were thinking more of the professional aspects rather than the working dynamics of firefighting. Now, I think you need a little bit of both. And so I said, you know, I was thinking about things as how they could be, and I said, why not? And if anybody can do this, I can do it. And so I did. I raised a whole bunch of money and hired editors and set about creating a magazine. It was a lot of work. Several times I thought we were going out of business. But, you know, being in business, I think there's only one key to success in being in business, and that is believing in what you do. And if you can believe in what you do, you'll find a way somehow to get through the hard times and every difficulty you take just as a sort of a personal challenge.
Sure,
it's the way firefighters look at it.
Absolutely.
At a job. So this is what I'm facing, and so what do I have to do? And let's do it fast. And don't take the time to ask all those questions. Just do what you have to do.
Well, Firehouse Magazine, I remember when the first issue came out, and I still have the first issue, and it was more truly like being in the firehouse. The other magazines are fantastic. Fire Command met a need. Fire Engineering continues to meet a very, very important need. And the others that are out there. But Firehouse sort of covered the technical, but also covered the coffee table stuff, too, if that makes sense, the kitchen stuff. And you had the social stuff in there. And it really sort of was... a little less technical, I mean, as technical, but added the other stuff as well. Does that make any sense?
I think what it did was, you know, I look at the idea of what magazines are supposed to accomplish, and I think that if you subscribe to any magazine and you get each month one article that you really internalize and that you can relate to, then I think that magazine has served its purpose, whether it's, you know, Saturday Review of Literature or TV Guide or anything else. And I think that's true of Firehouse. And when you leave, when I edited Firehouse Magazine so that I said, I want firefighters to read this magazine and come away with at least three memorable things out of every issue, whether they have to do with firefighters or themselves or a particular fire and confrontation and particular hazards or solutions, whatever. And then I found Hal Bruno, who is a great hero,
sure.
My great friend. And
Hal is the chairman of the board of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation.
He is that, and he's a, you know, he has been in the forefront of many issues in the American Fire Service.
Yep.
And Hal and I were good friends early on, and
he was the director of ABC News too, right?
He was the political director of ABC.
Political director of ABC News, right? Right. And you and him have been friends for years.
Right. And he started writing this column for us, which is still going on.
Right.
And so I tried to establish certain writers too that I identified early on. You know, people like Vinnie Dunn, I gave a lot of space
sure.
to.
Who still writes a column?
And John Normans, another guy who's
yep.
heading the special operations in FDNY now.
Right.
And I apologize to all those people I'm not naming because there are so
sure.
many of them, and including yourself, Billy, who you know who began publishing in Firehouse some years ago, and. You know, and of course you in your own way are becoming a legend in the fire service. But but this is the whole point of a great a medium of communications like Firehouse. It gives people like Billy Goldfeder an opportunity to say something important.
Yeah, where else we may not have had an opportunity, or our city manager told us don't say anything, so we wrote about it.
Yeah, right.
We're talking with Dennis Smith, author of a report from Engine Company 82, The Final Fire, Glitter and Ash, Steely Blue, History of Firefighting in America, Firehouse, Firefighters, Their Lives in Their Own Words, A Song for Mary, which honestly was my wife Terry's most favorite work that you did. We're going to come back in just a few seconds. We're going to talk about Report from Ground Zero. We're going to chat a little bit about San Francisco is Burning, which is your most current book. And then I want to talk to you about your most recent venture that's extremely exciting, focused directly at firefighters and first responders. So we'll be right back. This is Billy Goldfeder, listening to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is Through the Smoke.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
As the book says, the late, late show is on the television, and most of us are sitting in the kitchen when the bells start to ring. I take a last sip of tea, and I count 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4. The kitchen chair is empty as the last number comes in. It's box 2515, Intervale Avenue and Kelly Street. We can smell the smoke as the pumper turns down Intervale, and hands automatically start pulling boot tops to thighs, coat rings closing, and we're putting on our gloves. The pumper stops in front of the building just before we reach Kelly Street. We're about to stretch the hose when there's an anguished, screaming person from inside the building. A boy is running out of the doorway, and his shirt and his hair are aflame. Ladder 31 and Chief Sawin are right behind us, and one of the laddermen goes rapidly to the boy's assistance. Willie Knips takes the first folds of the hose and heads into the building. Carol and I follow, dragging the rest of the hose with us. Royce and Boyle are still on the sidewalk donning masks. I'll tell you, if you haven't read Report from Engine Company 82, and that would have to be some of the younger firefighters, we've got some links here at different places you can get that book. You want to read it. You want to add it to your collection. Well, Dennis, so much to talk about and so much, so little time, and I think it, hopefully we'll have you on as a guest again in the very near future. But let's fast forward to a date that anyone listening to this show was and is still is impacted by, and that's September 11th, 2001. And I'll jump forward quickly. You wrote Report from Ground Zero, but let's jump back and talk about your observations, your experiences. And you've been involved in a lot since September 11th, even politically, talking to Congress and the Senate. But let's jump back and really, where were you the morning of September 11th? What was your involvement, and then what motivated you to write that book, Report from Ground Zero?
Well, I was just, doing my annual physical examination, actually, and a nurse came in the room and said a plane just went into the World Trade Center. And so, of course, I immediately went home, and watched the television and saw that this was no accident, could say, tell that right away, and no plane that big is going to go into a building in New York. And I felt that I had to get down there right away. And, you know, Billy, I never anticipated the absolute tragedy that was to going that was going to come. I knew that it was, but it reminded me of like when the plane went into the Empire State Building, but that was a small plane.
Was that like in the 40s
or
47?
47,
right.
And the firefighters, you know, still talked about that job. It was like sort of a little history, and they had to walk all those steps, right? And so I'm thinking, well, this is a huge job. People were killed, obviously. I mean, you can't have a plane go into a building like that and not kill people. But still, I was thinking about the firefighters and that job, and I said, I have to get down there because this is going to be the biggest job of my life, and of all, particularly the firefighters' lives. Don't forget, I'm a retired guy. I've been retired for a long time. And so I immediately knew to go to Ladder 16, which is down on 67th Street. And I put on my fire department clothes. You know, I still have my fire department shirts and everything. And I have a badge.
Well, you're also an honorary chief on the job, too,
I have,
right?
Well,
so
the
you still
honorary
have your credentials.
Stuff, right,
and
credentials. And so, but I knew that the traffic would be mad, so I went down to 16 truck, and there were a bunch of firefighters there. And we commandeered a bus, a crosstown bus. We told everybody they could either stay on it or get off it, but there was not going to be another stop until we got to the 35 truck, which is over on 66th Street way over on the west side.
Uh-huh.
And there was another bus there waiting for us. And the fire department sprung into action, I mean, really quickly. And we got on that bus, and we headed downtown and got there just as the second building was falling. So, and then I stayed there for 60 days. You know, in the beginning, I never thought about writing a book. Never, ever. But then as the days went by, and the news media were, I mean, just absolutely mad for information. And I decided that I would do one interview really because I owed it to him, and that was Tom Brokaw. He said Tom Brokaw is an old friend of mine, and he has done many, many good things for me during my life in terms of giving me airtime and all of that. And his producer called and said Tom really wants you to come down. And so I went down and I did an interview with Tom. This was, I guess, three on the third night, right? The first two nights I didn't go. On the third night I took an hour and went to him to NBC, and then on the fourth night Peter Jennings asked me to do an interview, and I couldn't turn that down either because Peter was a friend and I know him for a long, long time.
And you lost him. Peter passed away last year, right?
And yes, a good friend, well missed. And so, you know, having done the interviews then, I began to recognize that there was a lot of information here that I was experiencing. And what was I going to do? Let some reporter who really doesn't know the fire service write about this? Or worse yet, some famous writer, and I won't name their names, but there are a lot of really, I think, inadequate people who are famous writers in America.
Mm-hmm.
to do this story and just for a sort of a rip-off. And not I shouldn't even say that, because maybe they would do it out of the goodness of their heart. But I'll tell you this, I gave $130,000 to the New York Police and Fire Widows and Children's Fund from that book.
Yes, right.
And I didn't see that coming from any of the other writers that wrote books during that time, and they didn't feel an urge to give back. And I think I would have just gone ahead and done it in any event, whether the book became a book or just my own notes. I thought that historically, for history, that this day and the succeeding days had to be accounted for by somebody who knew what they were talking about. And that's why I wrote Report from Ground Zero. It's a very difficult book. I will tell anybody who's listening to you, Billy, This is not an easy book to read. You have to be committed to understanding 9/11 to read this book. And you see how it affected and impacted the lives of all of those first responders.
And honestly, and how it impacted you. You lost dozens upon dozens of very dear friends.
That's very good friends. I lost many, many good friends. But I think of people like Pete Hayden, who's today the chief of the New York City Fire Department, and who just said, by the way, last week, it was quoted in the New York Times, the fire department just opened an incredibly beautiful monument on the side of the firehouse on Liberty Street, right at Ground Zero. It's a 60-foot-long bronze bas-relief monument. It's just so beautiful. And Pete Hayden, when he gave this speech, he said, you know, from everybody, all the people involved with Ground Zero over there, this is right across the street, right? He said, all we've been getting were empty promises from empty suits, but the fire department delivered. And, you know, this is true. The fire department and the police department as well, I got to say. These departments are asked to do something, they deliver. They don't sit on their hands. And so we have this incredibly beautiful monument up there at Ground Zero right now for the firefighters. The other monument at Ground Zero ever happen? Goodness knows. It's been four and a half years.
What a shame.
I will just bring my other book, San Francisco is Burning, into it now, because in San Francisco is Burning, 28,000 buildings burned in that fire and earthquake in 1906. 28,000. And that was good men making bad decisions. The chief got killed in the first 60 seconds. Well, he was taken out in the first 60 seconds. They brought a general in and let him supervise and control everything. He made one wrong decision after another, in my estimation. And that whole city was destroyed because of wrong decisions. And so, you know, this is another good lesson that there were, in 4.5 years, the city of San Francisco rebuilt that whole city in 4.5 years. Here it is, 4.5 years from September 11th, and there's still a big hole in the ground down there, and they haven't, the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation hasn't been able to do anything. But aside from that, this whole idea of good men making bad decisions, why I wrote this book on 1906, is because in emergency services in America, we have to get every citizen to understand that we have to put people who have emergency services background in these offices of emergency management.
And just prior to your interview here on this show, Dave Paulson, a very positive example of someone who gets it, someone who's done our job, and as you said, an emergency person now in charge of emergencies.
Right, and Dave Paulison is very often like a, you know, like a lone ship in the middle of the ocean. He's deeply ingrained in all of that politics of American emergency life, but he is this is a guy who knows his business.
He's a firefighter.
He's a firefighter.
Yeah.
So these are the things that I have tried to be about all of my life, and that is to do something that's relevant not only to the fire service, because I deeply care about firefighters and fire departments, but also for the country. The country needs to be protected as well. We live in perilous times, and not only for terrorism, but for natural problems, as we have seen, and hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and earthquakes and volcanoes. We have to be continually prepared for these emergencies, and particularly in the state and city office of emergency management. And
the local.
If the mayor is appointing lawyers who have worked on their campaigns to those jobs, that mayor should be recalled immediately. That's my feeling about it.
Let me. The other thing, and you certainly do give a lot, and two other organizations you're involved with. Dennis, is the September 11th Families Association in New York City.
That's the
working
tribute
with
center,
our right, the Tribute Center, which is going to be right next to Engine and Truck 10, opening hopefully this summer, run by people who understand what happened at 9/11.
Well, you're on that board too, Billy, and we're very lucky to have you. And that Tribute Center down there is. Again, it's just like Pete Hayden said, you know, we have a lot of empty promises from empty suits, but we're going to do it. This is going to be open in August. We have the state gave us $3 million. Port Authority gave us $3 million, and on $6 million, we'll be able to open a very important and truly commemorative place where people can understand 9/11.
It will matter.
It will make a difference, and it's not big and huge like the memorial is planned, but it is much more concentrated and focused, and I think much more sensible than the memorial that is planned. So
I think it's going to be the memorial. It's going to be what people think of while those involved downtown Manhattan are still screwing around
and
with each
other.
And
here's the point, Billy. That's right. We're getting it done.
Yeah.
And we're all pretty proud of that.
And again, for the listeners, there's links at the bottom here to the September 11th Families Association, the Tribute Center. It's all there for you. And Dennis, you're also involved, and I think pretty much, if I'm not mistaken, you and Gary Breeze kind of came up with this idea, the National Firefighter Near-Miss Reporting System.
This is very important, Billy, and you're on that board as well, and you know as well as anybody how these year after year static number of line of duty deaths in the fire service is just so sad and unfortunate at the family level. And you go to all those funerals,
absolutely,
and you see the terrible, tragic impact of this on other people, and to lose firefighters so young in their lives. You know, when we developed this commission, as you know, we have the director of safety for NASA, the director of safety for the FAA, the head safety person from the Pilots Association,
Coast Guard
safety person, and then from some of the more significant fire departments, the safety officers. So, but these people,
and Gordon Graham from the law enforcement side,
and Gordon Graham from the law enforcement side, guy who really knows what he's doing. So the point is that when you look at safety is a technology. It's a technology. You can judge safety problems and mitigate upon them. You can have programs that will reduce this terrible number of anywhere from 110 to 120 firefighters that we lose every year.
And the 80,000 plus serious injuries.
We can reduce this if we work together. Now, these near misses are important to report, because as you report them nationally, no one is, you know, it's completely confidential. There's no difficult.
Absolutely.
There's no problem with this in any way. It's fail-safe in terms of its reporting system. No one's going to get in trouble. No one's going to get harmed. No one's going to get brought up on charges.
And just trying to pick up data so
pick
we can start solving the
so
problem.
Can,
sure.
Right. And so go to,
we got the link right here. Yeah.
Go to
near
our
miss
link
reporting.
And take a look at the nearmissreporting.com. Firefighter Near Miss Reporting.
Firefighternearmiss.com. Sure, and the link's down there. They can click on that. So, San Francisco is burning. Let's just talk about that. You started to talk about that for a little bit. Let's talk about that just for a couple minutes, because then I want to talk about your most recent venture. And I'm not sure, but I know it kind of all came about after Katrina, when you saw some very serious needs for firefighters, police officers, and other first responders. But where'd San Francisco's burning come from?
Well, I think that after I wrote Report from Ground Zero, I've written a book every 2 years for the last 30 years, and I just decided I wanted to write another book, and I said, I want to write a book about something that has a history, very involved in history, but also that has, because I love the idea, if you can't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so
and
that
really,
was,
Dennis, that ties into what we're doing with near-miss reporting, actually.
Yes, exactly,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So anyway,
and,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
And so I felt that I looked at the Morro Castle fire. I looked at all kinds of important fires in the Chicago fire. I looked at the Baltimore fire. I read about all of these things, and deciding what is it that I want to do where there's a real lesson. And then I came upon the San Francisco earthquake in 1906, and it, you know, geology interests me a lot, science interests me a lot.
Right.
But then the dynamics of San Francisco, the cultural times there, all these newfound wealth, American wealth in San Francisco, is the wealthiest place west of the Mississippi. It had the tallest buildings west of the Mississippi. It was the fastest growing city in America. It had all the wealth from the diamond, the silver lodes and the gold lodes.
It was really the heart of the West Coast of America.
And, right, all the railroad wealth ended up in San Francisco. So, and then they had this tragic earthquake, and after the earthquake they had these fires and that were uncontrollable. Why? Because there was no water system. The water system had broken apart during the earthquake, but the fire chief had anticipated this, and every year for the 5 years before had gone to the what they call the Board of Supervisors, which is like city council, asking to create a high pressure water system so that they would be able to have a water supply in case of an earthquake. And they turned them down year after year after year, and I thought that was incredibly malfeasant of them. And, you know, people who run cities have a responsibility not just the present but the future. They have to be thinking about future all the time. And so there was the dynamics of the politics of the time. There was a lot of corruption in San Francisco as well, political corruption, incredible political corruption. The fire department was a great fire department. They had 575 firefighters. The fire chief, poor guy, I mean, he didn't die until 4 days later, but he sort of went unconscious in the first 60 seconds and never came out of it because he fell down a hole during the earthquake that brought him down in a firehouse four stories below, and he landed next to a boiler that had pipes disconnected because of the shaking earth and burned him severely. Dennis Sullivan was his name. He was a great fire chief. I know a lot about him and read a lot about him. And that absence of Sullivan's absence, because a fire chief is supposed to have hegemony, you know, complete power in an emergency situation. And then this general came in, and he sort of took control, General Funston, who was a good man, by the way. He was a good man. He won the Medal of Honor. He was courageous, heroic, adventurous. He was everything that a kind of person you and I, Billy, would love to have dinner with.
Right.
Just a great guy. But he made the wrong decisions. He was a general. He did not come out of the emergency services, even
exactly.
In 1906. Yep. He did not know how to mitigate. All he knew how to do was to surround and control. Now, that is not the best way to deal with an emergency.
Right.
The emergency, as we all know, is that you see chaos before you all the time, and you eat at the edges of that chaos in a mitigating way until you have some semblance of control.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do that. He completely made the wrong decisions time after time, including dynamiting, which was the worst thing to do at that time. And so I thought I wanted to write a book about good people making bad decisions, and it related to these people who I've seen who were appointed to these high offices at Homeland Security and Office of Emergency Management throughout the country. And I wanted to send a message to the people of this country that unless you have emergency service experienced professionals in those jobs, you're putting your lives in your hands, and as far as I am concerned.
You're exactly on target.
And then New Orleans, of course, was sort of proved that, didn't it?
It showed people
who were not really competent to that kind of an emergency. And then what happened? All they did was blame FEMA. But boy, there was a lot more to blame than FEMA in that situation, and anybody in the emergency services could see it. So,
yeah, I mean, FEMA's the last resort, and clearly when FEMA is called in, they better be able to fix the problem.
Right.
But
right.
Locally, it's our responsibilities first, and then the county, then the state, et cetera.
Right, exactly.
Well, let's talk about that just for a second. Right around that time, now you've always had an interest in finance, managing money. You wrote a column for a while, and still do occasional articles for firefighters on their finance and managing their funds and stuff, which is really tough for a lot of us. Making what we do. Trying to make ends meet, and you've provided a lot of advice for that, and now from that has come First Responders Financial. Let's talk about that a little bit.
This is another thing where I said that there is something needed and to see something and say, well, why not? I mean, I know I can do this, and so why not me? If I don't do it, who will? The point is here that there are financial companies and insurance companies in America who serve only, exclusive to the military, for instance. There's one company just for the military. There's another company just for school teachers. And when you have a company that's just for a group like that, they're able to make better deals. They're able to bring large numbers to you know, the big companies like Merrill Lynch or Lehman Brothers, whatever, and say, look, I want a better deal for these people, and if you can make a better deal, I'll bring it to them. And that is a tremendous amount of gravitas, you know, if you can do that. And I said, well, I mean, I think I can do that. And because I have always been interested in economics, you know, when I started Firehouse Magazine, it was a very enterprising business. It required a lot of money. We had a lot of people working for us. And I had to understand where that money was, how it was working, where it was going, what we did with our reserve accounts, what we did with our investment accounts. All of these things interested me, and I learned a great deal about it. And so I was able to write these financial columns because I had taken the financial advisor, the Series 7 SEC test, and passed it. And so I got to say that when I created First Responders Financial, I did it really with so much love in my heart for this idea, the idea of serving first responders exclusively.
Well, let's take a look at that. Firefighter making $40,000 a year. The firefighter's spouse maybe bringing in another $30,000-$40,000 a year. It's not a lot of money. It should be noted that you know, First Responders Financial is a business, and it's a business being offered to firefighters. And why, if it's so tough for me to make ends meet anyway, why do I want to consider what your company has to offer?
Well, here is the thing. Every person has to make a decision about how they allocate the money in their own family.
No matter what you make.
No matter what you make. And one of the things that should impact on that decision is your understanding that, you know, life is a continuum, and you're young, you get to middle age, you get old. As you get older, you know, when you're young, you say, well, my pension will take care of it. When you're in middle age, you say, well, you know, I wish my pension were a little better because I have a pretty nice standard of living now, at least acceptable to me, and
right.
I want to maintain it. And my pension doesn't look like it's going to maintain it because I'm going to go down to half my salary.
Sure.
And so, you know, you need to be thinking about these kinds of things in your life. It's called financial planning. And you know, the responsible thing is to go to a company and talk to a financial planner and so on and invest your money wisely. But, you know, the reality is, unless you have $100,000 or $200,000 or even $500,000 to some of these companies, they're not interested in you.
And that would be none of us listening to this show today.
That's exactly right. And that is exactly right. And so I said, well, look, I think I can bring pretty good deals, whether it's car insurance or home insurance or life insurance or financial investment products or credit cards or mortgages. This is the ambition for First Responders Financial. And the company will live or die, float or sink, based on its ability to bring good deals to first responders, because you cannot run a company unless you make money. You know, companies are not charities.
Sure.
And in order to make create a company that does real service, you have to bring real value to the customer. And one thing I know about everybody who works with us, that they really genuinely care about first responders. They care about these firefighters and these EMTs and law enforcement officers and nurses. And the reason nurses are in, you know, this is a real serious question. Every protocol that I've ever read in Office of Emergency Management, and I've read a lot of them, always includes nurses of some kind, you know, whether they're trauma intervention or ER nurses or transport nurses or whatever, but nurses are always a part of our package. And of course, we in the fire service have known for many years that we depend on nurses a lot in our own emergency situations, and they're always there for us, and they quite frankly identify with us very often.
So this is basically police, fire rescue, EMS, and the nursing field.
That's exactly
who
right.
You're targeting.
These are the first responders. These are people who I think give an awful lot of their lives with extreme dedication and care and concern for, you know, quite frankly, not an awful lot in return.
And the services offered are on your website?
The services are at firstresponders.com.
And we're going to have a link to that here on the page also,
oh,
so they can
great.
Click right to it.
So, and firstresponders.com is just a few months old, you know, and we're just out there now. I think it's going to take a while for the first responders to see what I am doing, that this company is has been developed by really by people who care about them and care about them only. It's not like we're a company seeking to bring them, you know, them and other people under one tent.
Well, you know, generally my attitude with stuff is if I have a choice, I'd rather deal with a firefighter in a business or anything like that.
Well,
it's
we're
just,
certainly
it,
hoping
it,
that's
it's our
true.
Family, you know.
We're certainly hoping that's true. But at the same time, you know, we all have a cousin that's not smart enough to deal with us, right?
And, crazy and, uncle in the basement.
Right, a crazy uncle in the mix. And but essentially, I want first responders to judge us by our abilities and what we offer and the tremendous benefits. I mean, if you sign up now for first responders, for instance, and it's just a question of becoming a participating first responder, it doesn't cost anything, does not cost a penny.
Well, check it out.
You right. then go right into our responder rewards program, which is it's not just the normal discounts on you know, affinity program discounts.
Right.
These are really good discounts, particularly if you're going to go on vacation or if you're getting engaged and need a diamond ring or if you're buying clothes or
sure.
furniture. Now, I got to tell you, I, Dennis Smith, and First Responders Financial do not make a single penny on these benefits programs. I have negotiated this. There are 1,200 retailers involved in our Responders Rewards program, and we don't make a penny. We do this just for as a service for first responders.
That's something else.
And also, I got to tell you, it was not an easy thing to bring a big program like this to first responders, because they normally require companies that have 40,000 employees or more.
Large. And you're doing this individually.
And we're
the individual firefighter.
I mean, we'll have well over 40,000 people. That's not yeah. my. We'll have
sure.
you know, hundreds of thousands of people. But the thing is that they recognize this, you know. This benefits company recognized that they want to do this for first responders, and it's the future and the preservation of their safety in the future. And so they responded. And, you know, quite frankly, when I meet with the chairman and the presidents of these very large companies, all well-known companies, Billy,
right.
we will not do business with a company that is not.
No, by looking at your website, I see some obvious
yeah.
names anybody's going to recognize.
Exactly sure. right. And we'll only do business with those reputable companies because we feel that the first responders, their futures and their insurance and their investment should only be in the hands of people who have been doing this for decades and decades and who have really great reputations.
Well, every one of us has an income, and every one of us has needs and insurance and things like that. So check out the website and do some exploring. How in the hell can a fire get going like that before someone turns in an alarm? He continues to shake his head in dejection. And that police lock, what a mark of the poor when they have to barricade themselves in their house like that. What is it, I ask him, looking toward his arms. It's a little girl about 2 years old. She never had a chance at this fire, but at least they got her mother and sister out. Did you give her mouth to mouth, I asked? We couldn't. She was roasted so bad the skin was burnt completely off her face. The poor little girl, she never had a chance. I don't see anything further, nor does he. I look up at his eyes. They are almost fully closed, but I can see they are wet and tearing. The corneas are red from the heat and the smoke, and the light reflects the watered surfaces as they sparkle. I wish my wife, my mother, everyone who's ever asked me why I do what I do as a firefighter could see the humanity, the sympathy, the sadness of these eyes in my brother firefighter, because in them is the reason I continue to be a firefighter. That's the last paragraph in report from Engine Company 82, because we're done with the interview. Dennis, thank you so much for your time today. I know you're extremely busy, and the fact that you took the time to talk to us today means a lot. Any final quick thoughts?
Billy, I just want to thank you, and I want to thank Firehouse.com, and I want to thank all of those men and women who took the time to listen to this today. I appreciate you all being with me today.
Thanks
so much.
Dennis.
Right on.
You're listening to Through the Smoke, Firehouse.com, radio at Firehouse.com. The show is produced by Eric Smith and hosted by Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder. I'll talk to you soon.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.